This podcast is supported by Evernorth Health Services.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Tonight on 360, a CNN exclusive, President Biden one-on-one for the first time threatening to withhold certain U.S. weapons if Israel invades Rafah. Also tonight, breaking news after weeks of talking about it, far-right Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene tries to unseat Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson. What members did about her motion to vacate his chair and what her fellow Republicans now might do about her. Plus, what to expect from day two of Stormy Daniels' testimony and why the former president's defense team may now want to maximize her time on the stand. Good evening. Thanks for joining us. We begin tonight with breaking news. President Biden today sat with CNN for a rare exclusive interview during a stop in the battleground state of Wisconsin. He talked about the election, which we'll get to in a moment, but he's making headlines right now for what he said about Israel's ongoing war with Hamas, which has become the focal point of college protests in the U.S. and abroad. The interview comes with CIA Director Bill Burns in the Middle East at this moment, working on a ceasefire. Here, speaking with CNN's Aaron Burnett, President Biden for the first time laying out a new condition for aid to Israel.
I want to ask you about something happening as we sit here and speak, and that, of course, is Israel is striking Rafah. I know that you have paused, Mr. President, shipments of 2,000-pound U.S. bombs to Israel due to concern that they could be used in any offensive on Rafah. Have those bombs, those powerful 2,000-pound bombs, been used to kill civilians in Gaza?
Civilians have been killed in Gaza as a consequence of those bombs and other ways in which they go after population centers. And I made it clear that if they go into Rafah, they haven't gone into Rafah yet. If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah, to deal with the cities, to deal with that problem. We're going to continue to make sure Israel is secure in terms of Iron Dome and their ability to respond to attacks like came out of the Middle East recently. But it's just wrong. We're not going to supply the weapons and the artillery shells used that have been used.
Artillery shells as well.
Yeah, artillery shells.
So, just to understand what they're doing right now in Rafah, is that not going into Rafah as you define it?
No, they haven't gone into the population centers. What they did is right on the border, and it's causing problems with right now in terms of with Egypt, which I've worked very hard to make sure we have a relationship and help. But I've made it clear to Bibi and the War Cabinet, they're not going to get our support if, in fact, they go in these population centers.
Joining us now is CNN Chief National Security Correspondent Alex Marquardt, also two former White House Communications Directors, Kate Bedingfield, who served in the Biden administration, Alyssa Farr Griffin, who served in the previous administration. Alex, first of all, how do you think these comments are going to be received by Israel? Because Netanyahu has made very clear how important they believe going into Rafah is.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to go down very well, Anderson, when they take full stock of what Biden is saying here. And I really think that this is the most significant shift in this question of American aid for Israel to date. Biden saying very clearly the U.S. will no longer send some of the biggest weapons that the U.S. has been sending to Israel, bombs, artillery, et cetera, if Israel goes into those population centers in Rafah. Now, earlier today, Anderson, we heard from the IDF, they essentially had dismissed the holdup of one American shipment of bombs, essentially saying that they're working through it. This is just a temporary delay. But Biden making very clear here that there is a change in American policy, and that if Israel does not heed this American warning to not go into Rafah without a more comprehensive plan, that American support will stop on the offensive front. Now, I've spoken to members of the administration tonight. U.S. is making very clear they are differentiating between offensive and defensive weapons. Biden saying in the same interview that they will continue to help defend Israel, as we saw with the attack by Iran against Israel. They will continue to help with the Iron Dome system. But there's now a major question of how much longer the U.S. will continue to support Israel offensively if essentially Israel defies the U.S. And goes into Rafah, goes into these population centers. It's a very, very stark warning.
It seems like there may be room, some sort of wiggle room here, because the administration, the Biden administration, has for a long time now been urging restraint from Israel in any action in Russia, in Rafah and elsewhere, and trying to sort of move them more to, sort of more targeted special forces type operations to try to root out or kill members of Hamas, or obviously search for hostages. Israel has called their operation in Rafah, strategic strikes, which may just be a branding exercise. But if Israel was willing to maybe adopt more the tactics that the Biden administration wants, perhaps there's wiggle room there.
We've been told this for months, Anderson. I was in Israel back in December when Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, said that they anticipated that Israel would start switching to what he was calling a lower intensity phase of this war, expected in January. And that simply hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. And so this is a shot across the bow by the Biden administration. You could hear the president there in that clip saying that essentially this Rafah operation hasn't started in earnest. And the U.S. understands that Israel does want to take that part of the Rafah border with Egypt to better control that. Israel certainly sees this Rafah operation, limited as it is right now, as a way to pressure Hamas to perhaps agree to a ceasefire deal. But Anderson, Israel has made no bones about the fact that they do plan to go into Rafah, that there are four Hamas battalions there that remain, and they can't eradicate Hamas without going in, while the U.S. does disagree and says you have to go in a much more strategic way, a much more tactical way. And here the president is saying that, adding to that, we're not going to give you the weapons to do what it is that you want to do, adding to that pressure to go in much more tactically, Anderson.
You know, Kate, you think back to President Biden's first visit to Israel after October 7th, and the Israelis greeted that with, joy and amazement over the support that Biden was offering Israel for what they were calling a total war. This is obviously a big change. Obviously, the president's under extraordinary political pressure here in the United States and globally. What do you think of this line he's now drawing?
Well, I think as somebody who worked for Joe Biden for a long time and watched him up close making these kinds of foreign policy decisions, I think contextually it's important for people to understand that he doesn't make these decisions lightly. He doesn't make them in a knee-jerk way. You've been discussing, for the last few months, he and his team have been working directly with the Israelis to push them to a more tactical approach to Rafah. I mean, this is something that has been a priority for him as he's worked to try to discourage the Israelis from from conducting raids that have left such broad-based casualties. So, this is not the kind of thing that Joe Biden says or does solely under political pressure. I think this is a reflection of where the conflict has moved over these last 7 months now. You've seen him consistently try to put public pressure, particularly over the last few months, on Netanyahu and the Israeli government to try to minimize casualties. And so this is from what I can see, this is simply the next step. I mean, this is him saying, we're going to put action behind our words here. So I think, as people are absorbing this and kind of understanding why Joe Biden is making this decision now, I think it's important to have that context. That is the way that he approaches this kind of decision making. And for him, it's less about the political pressure. If it were solely about the political pressure, then, you would have seen movement from him over the last few weeks as, pressure was ramping up on these college campuses. But that is not the lens that he uses to make these kinds of consequential decisions, where he's weighing, maintaining American security interests in the region, standing by our ally in Israel, and simultaneously trying to reduce the suffering that we're seeing in Gaza. Those are complicated things to balance. And so he's trying to strike that balance.
Alyssa, Israeli officials have made the point repeatedly that any weakening or any lack of resolve shown by the U.S. in support of Israel plays into the hands of Hamas, certainly at the negotiating table, makes it less likely. I mean, there are a lot of Israeli officials who will tell you or believe that having a strong military response
encourages negotiations, encourages Hamas to make concessions.
Well, and Alex alluded to that. I think this is being, this announcement by Joe Biden's being panned by the right, the center, and even some moderate Democrats. John Fetterman called it disappointing because a key part of the Rafah invasion is using it as leverage as a ceasefire is attempting to be negotiated. And what wasn't talked about in depth in this interview is there are hostages. There are also still American hostages. So this sort of standoffish, as though America doesn't have a vital role in this, I think is not being received well politically. But Joe Biden runs into the could run into alienating the left, who is not going to buy the IDF is not in Rafah. You see the explosions. You see that they are physically there in parts of it, though, on the border. But then on the center right, the Nikki Haley swing voters who will determine this election, feeling like he said he had an ironclad commitment to Israel, yet this does not bring of an ironclad commitment.
Alex, I mean, in terms of Israel's response to this, you know, they have repeatedly, or Netanyahu has repeatedly made the, basically downplayed the civilian casualties. And I mean, the, you know, they talk about the numbers of Hamas fighters that they claim to have killed. There's no way to independently verify that. And the number of civilians killed as well. Obviously, the images coming out of Gaza are horrific. The number of children, there's so many children in the population, so many women being killed. And, you know, we see these videos every single day. They are horrific to watch. I'm wondering what you made of the moment that President Biden, you know, acknowledged that civilians have been killed in Gaza as a consequence of, you know, some of these 2,000-pound bombs that the U.S. has supplied by Israel. I mean, it's a statement of fact.
It is a statement of fact. I think it's a remarkable admission. I mean, this has been the biggest criticism by people who want to see this war end as soon as possible, that the U.S. continues to supply Israel with the weapons, and in turn, they continue to carry out these strikes that have led to this enormous death toll. Anderson, you're absolutely right that Israel has kind of quibbled with those figures. But even if you look at Israel's figures of around 15,000 Hamas fighters killed, you're still talking about around 20,000 civilians, most of whom are women and children. And so what you hear in that moment is the president really reckoning with the death toll that has happened in many ways at the hands of American weapons. And he said very pointedly, it's just wrong. And so he kind of he certainly wants to see, you know, that the killing with these American bombs and the U.S. has talked repeatedly about how the civilian death toll is too high. But until now, they really haven't taken any steps to constrain Israel. We've had this remarkable moment for the past few months where American bombs have been dropping on Israel. And at the same time, American aid has been dropping in Israel. The Pentagon is going through to extraordinary lengths to build this pier off the coast of Gaza to get aid in. And so it's just been this remarkable contradiction.
You said aid and bombs have been dropping in Israel, been dropping in Gaza, you meant?
Sorry, into Gaza, yeah. Yes. The aid drops coming from the planes, from the Americans, aid coming in from the sea, from land. So it's just been incredible. Anderson, we should note, this is extremely symbolic, and this is a real signal to Israel, of course. Israel could plow ahead and carry out an operation in Rafah on the ground and from the sky. They do have enough weapons to do that. They do have enough of these bombs. But this is a strong message to Israel that we are no longer going to send these weapons if you go into these populated areas and continue to kill civilians.
Anderson. Alex Marquardt, Kate Bedingfield, Alyssa Farr Griffin, thank you. Now more breaking news. Another attempted Republican mutiny on Capitol Hill. Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene trying to unseat House Speaker Mike Johnson, then seeing her attempt get smacked down. Now the question is, what just happened here? Speaker Johnson has just weighed in. So is the former president on his social network, urging Republicans to defeat her motion to vacate the speaker's chair, but only posting it at 5:59 p.m., several minutes after the vote took place. CNN's Melanie Zanona has been talking to House members, and her sources joins us now with the latest. So how did House Republicans react when Green called up this resolution, and how quickly did they move to kill it?
Well, I can tell you, Anderson, that GOP leadership was completely caught off guard. I'm told that Marjorie Taylor Greene did not give advance notice to Johnson that this was coming. But Johnson knew all along that it was possible she would force a floor vote on this motion to vacate this week. So he did have a plan in place, which was to immediately schedule the vote the moment that she called it up. And that is exactly what he did. And as you saw, that motion was easily defeated with the help of Democrats. But even though it did easily fail, Republicans are still furious with Marjorie Taylor Greene for following through with this threat, and some are even calling for consequences. Take a listen.
Right now, we're all focused on making sure that this institution continues to function. And I think today we showed that we're tired of the chaos and the nonsense.
This pathetic rerun of an awful syndicated TV series needs to come to a close. I think that there needs to be accountability. I don't think people should be, some people here think they're more important than everyone else. They are not. And there needs to be accountability for that.
Look, I think it's idiotic. Moscow Marjorie has lost her mind, clearly the result of a space laser. There needs to be consequences, including the loss of committee assignments. Chip Roy and Thomas Massie, who serve on the Rules Committee, should both be removed immediately.
Now, Johnson has not advocated for any consequences, but he has said that they need to change the House rules next year. And he also said off the House floor today that he hopes after this vote, they can put all these messy fights that have defined the 118th Congress behind them finally.
She had a bunch of meetings with Johnson over the last couple of days. Did she give a reason for trying to force this vote?
There was some sense that she was trying to find an off-ramp, trying to find some resolutions, perhaps because Donald Trump himself, I'm told, called her over the last week and urged her to back down and to not follow through with this. So she did meet with Johnson several times this week. She laid out a list of demands in exchange for backing down, but Johnson was in no hurry to make a decision. And he was also very clear that he was not willing to negotiate with her. He was just willing to hear out her ideas. So ultimately, she decided to pull the trigger today, which is the last day that the House was voting this week. And so we'll see whether she continues to force these floor votes in the future, but she has not ruled out doing so, Anderson.
Melanie Zanona, thank you. Coming up next, new developments in the hush money trial and the former president's fight against the gag order, limiting what he can say about it. New details as well as about the defense's fresh willingness, it seems, to keep Stormy Daniels on the stand longer, despite everything she said to prosecutors yesterday, or maybe because of it. Also, my conversation with Whoopi Goldberg about her loss in the space of just a few years of her mom and her brother, the effect their deaths had on her, and the remarkable story she tells about in her new book, Bits and Pieces, My Mother, My Brother, and Me. We'll be right back.
Me too, I think.
Grief is a human experience, and the care we receive should be too. Evernorth Behavioral Health ensures all members have access to live, specialized support in person or virtually with a 100% follow-up commitment to make sure they get the help they need. There's always a person there, guiding your employees using data-driven risk monitoring tools so bottled-up feelings don't turn into further suffering. With Evernorth's wide range of behavioral solutions, care can be personalized, simple, and more accessible. Learn more at evernorth.com/grief support. All There Is with Anderson Cooper is supported by Evernorth Health Services. Grief is a human experience. Shouldn't the care we receive feel human too? That's why Evernorth Behavioral Health ensures all members have access to live, specialized support anytime, in person or virtually, with a 100% follow-up commitment to make sure that they get the help that they need. So no matter what stage of grief your employees may be in, there's always a person ready to listen. Stressful times can lead many to bottle up complex feelings, especially at work. 59% of those suffering say nothing. This can have unexpected and serious mental and physical health implications. And with Evernorth's data-driven risk monitoring tools, they can help spot challenges early and step in to guide individuals to care before they undergo any more suffering. Each person's grief is as unique as they are, which is why Evernorth offers a wide range of personalized behavioral solutions to meet the needs of every member that they serve. Learn more at evernorth.com/grief support.
There's a major new development tonight ahead of Stormy Daniels' second day of testimony when the New York hush money trial picks up tomorrow. Though it will not affect the case immediately, it could in the weeks ahead. Late today, a New York appeals court ordered both sides to submit final briefs by May 20th, 12 days from now, on the former president's challenge to his gag order. As you know, he's already been cited with contempt 10 times for violating it and has been warned he could face jail time if he doesn't again. His attorneys earlier today asked the appeals court to expedite their ruling on whether the gag order passes constitutional muster. Now, before that happens, Stormy Daniels will be back on the stand tomorrow for another day of cross-examination by the defense. Tonight, what that might look like, what the defense could try to exploit, and what tools are available to prosecutors for containing any damage from a witness who so far has been both compelling at times and problematic. Joining me now, best-selling author and former federal prosecutor Jeffrey Toobin, seen as Kara Scannell, who's been in court forever throughout this trial, former federal judge Shira Shenlin, and CNN senior legal analyst Ellie Honig. Kara, what's the latest on the gag order?
So they made this filing today asking the appeals court to expedite their decision on whether the gag order was constitutional or not.
the appeals court came back and said briefs due by the 20th. Now, prosecutors have said they expect to rest their case around May 21st. So it doesn't seem like there's going to be a ruling on this gag order while the prosecution is still calling witnesses. And, of course, that is the issue here, whether what Donald Trump can say about any possible witnesses.
Judge, what do you think of the gag order? What do you think of this never-ending battle over the gag order?
It does seem to be a never-ending battle, but do I think the appellate division will cut it back? Possibly. There are parts of it that I think are a little bit vague, a little bit not totally clear, and they may try to pin it down a little better. That's what I think. I don't think they'll overturn it. I don't expect that.
What would be ways to kind of organize it differently?
Well, for example, you're not allowed to make comments about jurors. But is it a comment about jurors to say this is a heavily Democratic district? That's an example that's always stood out to me. That's not really talking about the jurors. It's a fact that this district, where the jurors are drawn from, is heavily Democratic. And Trump got 12% of the vote. So I understand his change of venue argument from the beginning. He sort of feels this isn't a venue for me to get a fair trial, just like the government isn't truly happy anymore in Florida. So I understand that maybe defining what it means to comment about jurors is something that could be a little bit pinned down. That's just an example.
I think we're talking client maintenance here for the lawyers. I mean, Trump is obsessed with this gag order. These lawyers are trying to get him acquitted in this trial. They do not need to be arguing about this gag order, which, as you point out, any ruling will be after the trial anyway. This is entirely his obsession, his pushing for political, not legal reasons, the idea that he's some sort of First Amendment victim. But I am sure his lawyers have said to him, can we not spend time on this and instead spend time on trying to get you acquitted? But I think this shows that this is Trump's political
agenda. To that end, do you think tomorrow that they are going to spend more time with Stormy Daniels than they might have otherwise?
Well, I actually think that they've gotten most of what they need out of Stormy Daniels. She is someone who hates Donald Trump. She acknowledges that. She has a financial interest in the outcome of this case. She will make more money if Donald Trump is acquitted. What more do you need? If they start asking her about her description of the sex between them, they're just going to let her repeat all of what she said. You know, I just think less is more.
I agree with that. I know we have new reporting at CNN. Paula Reed, I think you too, Kara, right?
Not me.
Oh, sorry. All right. You have so many stories. It's how can I keep it straight? But we have new reporting at CNN that they do plan to cross-examine her for longer than they originally intended tomorrow. I think that's a mistake. It's a common lawyer mistake. We lawyers, I'll plead guilty to this, sometimes do this, where if a little bit is good, more must be better. And that does not apply, especially in cross-exam. They are off to a very good start. In the hour or 90 minutes that they cross-examined Stormy Daniels the other day, pick up there, do another hour, just remind the jury that she's biased, she hates Trump, she is desperate to see him behind bars, she's told conflicting versions of this story before. Leave it at that. You don't need to go back in that hotel room. It's the last thing you want to do.
No, I agree with that, but I disagree with you in a way. It depends on the witness. Some witnesses wear down and wear out. And she may blow it if they keep her going for hours and hours. She may just say something that's very, very strange and affects the jury. I don't think this jury likes this woman anyway. And the more she talks, the less they may like her.
What one point about Stormy Daniels that is worth remembering, she has been a witness in the building next door, your old courthouse, where she was a witness against Michael Avenatti. She was the key witness in the case about him stealing from her. And the jury loved her. The jury believed her.
I covered that trial, and I saw her testimony. And her demeanor is very different in that case than it is in this case.
Really?
That was a case about her financial records and not getting her book advance. I felt she was very composed. She was very on top of her business. She seemed like a savvy businesswoman and just was able to tell the story differently. In this instance, she does seem more scattered, whether it's more nervous. Obviously, the stakes are different here, and it's a different type of issue. She's talking, yes, it is about the payment, but it's also about her encounter with Trump. And she just comes across a little bit more uneasy with her question, with her answers, and that she was trying to appeal to the jury in such a way that her jokes didn't really land. She was trying to engage with them more, and that didn't really
She strikes me that she has an agenda. She is trying to get this man convicted, and that's coming through, at least to me.
Her descriptions of the sexual encounter on the witness stand were different than in past a lot of past interviews, the one I did with her on 60 Minutes, for instance, you know, this time she said, you know, it was entirely consent, was consensual. When I interviewed her, though, she certainly felt like, oh, what have I gotten myself into? This, she talked about blacking out, which she described as sort of a losing feeling in her hands and stuff, not remembering certain moments of it. In fact, at one point, the prosecutor said something to the effect of, like, is that just a newly recovered memory, which is actually a term that's used.
Right.
Do you think they will go after that?
Absolutely. That's how you cross-examine a story like this. You're not going to get Stormy Daniels to recant on the stand. She's not going to say, I made it all up. I don't personally think she made it all up. But the way you undermine it is you say, you sat down with Anderson Cooper. You spoke to him for however long it was. Where in there did you say anything about passing out? Where in there did you say anything about he was blocking the doorway? Whatever it is. The other thing you do is she has made contradictory statements. She signed a statement in 2018 saying, this affair never happened, and I'm not denying it because I was paid hush money. I'm denying it because it did not happen. Now, she will have an explanation. She says she felt pressured and scared, and that's why she signed it. But this is the way real-life cross-examination works. It's not all Tom Cruise, you know, getting Jack Nicholson to admit he ordered the code red.
I'm only with you halfway on that, because I think you're right that the statement, you know, denying is a big problem for her, and that is worth focusing on. But going over the sexual encounter, even though there are what I would consider minor inconsistencies, I don't think if you were Donald Trump's lawyer, you want the jury thinking about what went on in that hotel room all the time or much time at all. Do the money, do the bias, do, you know, her fixating on how much she hates him. But I would stay out of that hotel.
I actually think I agree with you, but it'll be interesting to see whether Donald Trump's personal and political agenda compel his lawyers to get back into that.
And there's already the risk that if they do go down that road, the prosecution has a whole lot more they want to ask her. And the judge already put the guardrail there, but he said it's off if it goes there on cross.
Kara, Jeff, thanks very much. And Jen Lin as well. Ellie Honig, thank you very much. We have more now. I've seen an exclusive interview with President Biden next as we look at how students in the battleground state of Michigan balance their feelings about the war with those about the president. It's part of John King's All Over the Map series, looking at key voting groups in swing states. He joins us next. During President Biden's interview with CNN, he spoke about college protests over Israel's war against Hamas and their anger over his support for Israel.
Mr. President, you know, I have signs at college campuses. Some say Genocide Joe. Any of us that have gone to those campuses, sometimes we hear that chant. Do you hear the message of those young Americans?
Absolutely, I hear the message. Look, two things. First of all, there's a legitimate right to free speech and protest. There's a legitimate right to do that, and they have a right to do that. There's not a legitimate right to use hate speech. There's not a legitimate right to threaten Jewish students. There's not a legitimate right to block people access to class. That's against the law. That's against the law.
Those demonstrations have been especially intense in Michigan, a state Biden won by less than 3 percentage points in 2020, which also features a high number of Arab American voters. John King recently returned to Michigan to discuss the war and President Biden with young voters there. It's part of his ongoing series, All Over the Map, to experience the election through the eyes and experience of voters in key voting blocks and battleground states. And John King joins us now. I mean, it is tough to overstate the importance of Michigan.
Of Michigan and of the younger vote. And in Michigan also, you have the double whammy of the Arab American and the Muslim vote, giant in the state. We were there 5 months ago. It was bad for the president. That was at the beginning of this. We were just back there, Anderson. And I would say it is worse because this is literally double trouble for the president. I want you to look at this. This is the Arab American News. And it talks about the protests on campus. You see here, intifada on campuses they use. Intifada is a word that really angers Jewish students, makes them feel unsafe. But you see it here in the Arab American newspapers here. It hurts the president with young voters, with Arab Americans in a state like Michigan. They were key to his big win. And right now, 6 months to Election Day, giant trouble.
Protest amid the commencement celebration, a time-honored tradition on campus. But this one is complicated. Jade Gray and Anushka Jalasatki are now University of Michigan graduates and now former co-presidents of the College Democrats, proud their school is part of a global statement.
Was in my application letter that this was a campus of, like, a history of protest, a rich history of social justice movements.
Yeah. You
know. Worried, though, about months of war and death, months of student anger at a president who can't afford to lose Michigan.
how much is it going to hurt the president?
However much he decides.
Yes. That starts with calling for a ceasefire, for listening to the student voters across the country.
This is from our first visit 5 months ago. Protests against Biden's handling of the Israel-Hamas conflict were just beginning.
Is it fair to say you're glad the election's not tomorrow?
Yes.
The election was nearly a year away then, 6 months away now.
Michigan is up for grabs, and I did not think I'd be saying this right now, and I wish I wasn't saying this right now, but I am genuinely concerned about which way Michigan will go.
Both hope a summer away from campus protests helps younger voters see a bigger picture.
I'm certainly not voting for the guy who is in court right now and who incited an insurrection and put three extremists on the Supreme Court, who therefore took away rights for the first time in history, who's demonized the LGBTQ community, of which I'm a part of.
But right now, things are raw. Some friends talk about staying home or voting third party.
Hundreds of thousands of people in Gaza and in across Palestine have been displaced, have been starved, have been killed. So I think it really does come down to, you know, people's own judgments on the motivations of the president.
Oh, what a cute boy.
Summer Matkin is home in suburban Detroit, processing freshman year at Wayne State.
Can you talk about politics for me?
Back in November, big reservations about the president's age, but zero doubt if the choice was Biden or Trump.
I'd go Biden.
Now, not so sure.
No matter how many Taylor Swift references you make, you'll never understand us. My thing is, I think he has handled everything with Israel and Palestine terribly.
Still leaning Biden, but part of a consequential debate with friends.
A lot of our generation is also considering going third party, but I kind of fear it's going to split up the votes and end up having it fall back on Trump, which I wouldn't want to happen.
Maya Siegman began the school year likely Biden. Ends it? Definitely Biden. Happy with her grades, even more happy, it is over.
It was terrifying. It was terrifying. The escalation of other campuses has made me fear for my campus.
Siegman offers nuance often missing when politicians discuss the campus protests. No problem with calls to end the killing or to speed up humanitarian aid. But fear when she sees banners like this. The Intifada was a violent armed uprising targeting Jews.
You're wearing your Star David. You ever think of taking it off?
I did. I took it off, actually, for about a week or two. And then I put it on 4 or 5 months ago and never took it off.
A fierce supporter of Israel, but a fierce critic of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
I personally don't agree with how he is operating. I think that he is trying to prolong the war.
Ibrahim Ghazal also speaks with nuance. He is no fan of Hamas and acknowledges Israel's right to respond to terrorism.
We don't want human rights violations. If you're going to conduct war, conduct it within the rule of law, international law. That's all people are asking for, nothing more.
Ghazal is in two groups critical to Biden's Michigan math, a younger voter and an Arab American. He just wrapped his first year at Wayne State Law School.
It's been stressful just seeing people that look like me and just human beings, seeing human beings on my phone screen being killed day in, day out. And what's worse is, as an American, I have to see my government funding it. So, stressful.
A Biden voter in 2020 who says the president is in deep trouble in Detroit, Dearborn, and other Michigan communities where Arab and Muslim Americans number in the tens of thousands.
With older people, I would definitely say they're not voting for Biden. For younger voters, we're stuck in the sense that, you know, it's Biden or Trump. The only reason I haven't closed the door is because I think he still has an ability to change course and set a precedent for the future.
Ghazal's summer goals? Take a break. Then study the third-party candidates and watch to see if the president truly does change course or if the encampments are still a thing when classes resume in the fall.
John, I mean, of all the battleground states, Michigan, his win was the most comfortable, I guess. You look at Wisconsin, it was only 20,000 votes. Is that enough in Michigan to offset these problems you outlined?
It's a great question. My answer would be, as of today, no. Pennsylvania was 80,000, Wisconsin. Michigan was 154,000. So you say, oh, maybe the president has a little bit of wiggle room here. But look at this. Trump's share, 2020, 47%. Trump's share, 2018, when he won, 48%, if you round up both times. The third-party candidates hurt Hillary Clinton. The question is, will they hurt President Biden? So let's come forward to the Democratic primary. Remember, uncommitted was on the ballot in the primary. That was the protest vote against President Biden. It was largely students. It was largely Muslim and Arab Americans saying, we don't like your policy here. Where was it the biggest? Wayne County. Where it's in Wayne County, Dearborn. Dearborn Heights, Hamtramck. This is where tens of thousands, more than 100,000 Arab American, Muslim American voters live here in Wayne County. It's also where Wayne State University is. Uncommitted got 17% of the vote. Washtenaw County next door, move over. That's Ann Arbor. That's the University of Michigan. That's the students. Uncommitted got 17.2% of the vote. So if the president wants to recreate this in 2020, the presidential win, he has to make up. You heard the student at the end, Ibrahim Ghazal. Major policy shift. He's got 6 months. He's in trouble right now, but there's time.
Yeah, John King, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Coming up, my chat with Whoopi Goldberg on Living with Grief for an upcoming episode of my podcast, All There Is, when she lost her mom and brother within 5 years of one another. She writes in her new memoir that she felt alone, missing the only people who truly knew her. In a powerful moment with me, Whoopi answers the question she asked in her book, Why Did You All Leave Me Here? That's next.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
Okay, by now you have probably heard that rappers Kendrick Lamar and Drake went after each other in a once-in-a-generation rap battle. By the time algorithms were done, the Kendrick-Drake beef had reached far beyond the walls of hip-hop. What can we learn from the first great rap battle of the streaming age? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Whoopi Goldberg has been in the public eye for decades as a comedian, actor, co-host of The View. She's truly one of a kind. What you may not know about her is that behind the scenes, her remarkable mom, Emma, and her brother, Clyde, were her anchors. Their connection was extraordinarily deep all their lives. Whoopi's mom died in 2010 and her brother a few years later. Their deaths had a profound effect on Whoopi and still do. And she writes incredibly lovingly about them in a new memoir titled Bits and Pieces, My Mother, My Brother, and Me. The book is out this week. It is beautiful. I recently spoke to her for a future episode of my podcast, All There Is. The full interview will be available when the next season is released. Not sure when that's going to happen, but soon. But I wanted you to hear some of what Whoopi had to say.
You said after your mom died, you said, she'd prepared me for this day, but I would never be ready. I wasn't ready to not be her kid. And you also said, it took a while to settle in on me that my mom's death has been the most devastating experience of my life. It was an acute trauma. I still think about her every single day.
Yes, but I figured out, because one of the reasons I also thought I should write the book is because I didn't think I was responding correctly. And I couldn't figure out why. I couldn't figure out why I wasn't more devastated. And then a couple of days ago, I figured it out.
A couple of days ago?
Uh-huh. I figured it out a couple of days ago. There was nothing left unsaid with us. So there was no angst to find. There was that thing that I've seen in movies where I see people go through. I didn't go through it because my experience was, you know, I adored and loved you, and you were the center of my life, and the same with my brother. And we said it to each other all the time.
You said, I'm not in any rush to go wherever they went, but a lot of days I'm just sort of walking through it, getting where I need to go and doing what I need to do. I had no clue that things would change so dramatically for me once they were gone. Was I so tethered to my mom and brother that I can't find my own bearing? It feels that way. They were my home base, my reality check, because they both knew me from the start. And you also said, it's not like either one could have done anything about dying, but from time to time, I feel like, why did he all leave me here?
Yeah.
I asked that.
Yeah. Yeah. But the answer to that is because we have stuff we got to get done. That's why. And we're not supposed to. This is not our time. It's not our time. We got kids and grandkids and they need to know us. They need to know us. That's why. That's my belief, you know.
But yeah, that I find myself asking that question, like, why did you leave?
Yeah, why did you leave me? There were three of us.
I also realize when I ask that, that it's very much, it's the question like the 10-year-old me is asking.
Yeah.
Like, it's like the angry question of a hard-hearted child of like, why did you all leave?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I once flirted with thinking about leaving. And then I thought, what a terrible thing that would be to do to my kid, to knowingly do to my kid, who actually likes me. You know, she's a really good person and a fine woman, and she and her husband have raised three fine, very bizarre children. And why would you do that to them? Why would you leave them with that? So,
yeah,
decided not to. Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah, me too, I think.
You know, when somebody dies, people don't know what to say. And I've been doing this podcast. I still don't know what to say a lot of times. But I'm better at it now. But what do you know, you're writing the book about writing to people. And what do you say to people when you have a friend who's lost a loved one?
Well, I say, you know, no one who hasn't lost this way can understand. So you can't be mad at them for not saying the right thing, because even you don't know what the right thing is. So just let people love you. Let them come and love you and just appreciate that they're not going to know what you're feeling. They're not going to get, they can't read your mind. But know that all of these things are going to be coming at you. And you're going to get really pissed off because why are you talking to me like this? It's because they don't know what to say, you know? So I just recommend saying, I'm so sorry, and hug somebody. Or write them a note. Say, I don't know how to deal with this because it's never happened to me. Be honest.
Whoopi Goldberg is amazing. I love her, and her book is lovely and remarkable. And if you think you know her, and if you like her and you think you know her, there's a lot you can learn about her that's extraordinary that's in this book, and her amazing, amazing mom, Emma, who sounds a lot like my mom. We'll be right back. New video from police in Michigan after at least one tornado hit a town outside Kalamazoo Tuesday night. Significant damage occurred in homes and businesses. Officials there say more than a dozen were injured following a tornado. Right now, authorities south of Nashville, Tennessee, say a large tornado has hit. There are reports of significant damage along Interstate 64 in the area. We'll continue to follow the story. The news continues. The Source with Caitlin Collins starts now.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832 and tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.